Bowl Sunday use one of his most powerful speeches to sell a pickup truck. This is beyond comprehension.
You know, it's interesting because Dr. King delved deeply into income inequality and the destructiveness of poverty. He even said this country has socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor. What do you think he meant by that, and how did his thinking on poverty evolve?
Well, anyone who's been paying attention to what's going on in this economy for the last decade or so knows precisely what he's talking about. Keep in mind that when the banks and Wall Street tanked about a decade ago, their losses were socialized. That is to say, we had to pay for them, the working class people, the poor people, etc. And when they get profits, those are privatized. That is to say, they go to the 1%. With regard to the rest of us, the opposite basically obtains. As we speak, you know, I'm sure, that in December 2017, Congress passed another so-called tax reform bill, which is shoveling many more billions of dollars to the wealthy. And yet, Speaker Paul Ryan of the House of Representatives has already suggested that there will be a necessity to cut social programs, that is to say, healthcare and education, because the government does not have enough money, he says, precisely because of this tax cut. Dr. King, if he were alive, would understand what's going on perfectly.
It seems that Dr. King thought not only did he need to combat poverty for the moral reasons, but because he saw it as a critical threat to democracy. How do you view his concerns in light of our historic income inequality and the rise of political figures like the Koch brothers? How do you think Dr. King would have reacted to these events?
Well, it's obvious that this is a contradiction to the concept of democracy. That is to say that we have in this country, I'm afraid, at least in certain circles, a very narrow conception of what democracy means. It basically means trooping to the ballot box on the first Tuesday in November and casting a ballot for one candidate or another who's supported by the corporate media and their backers. We're not talking about democracy in the workplace, for example. We're not talking about the democracy in terms of the sharing of the wealth that corporations like General Motors and Microsoft and Apple are generating. We need to reform and refashion and radicalize, indeed, our very primitive conceptions of democracy. And I'm sure that if he were alive today, Dr. King would be in the forefront of those who are espousing that particular doctrine.
So, Professor, let's move on to one of his last speeches at the Riverside Church in New York. He took on the topic of the Vietnam War, and he called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Does his characterization hold true today?
Well, it not only holds true today, but it holds true historically. Keep in mind that although some have forgotten, the United States of America is an exemplar of settler colonialism. That is to say, hundreds of years ago, you had European invaders who ousted the Native Americans from the land and then went to Africa and kidnapped those like my ancestors and brought them back here to work for free. And then after the Native Americans were swept from the Atlantic to the Pacific and ousted, the United States then went abroad to places like Hawaii and Puerto Rico to basically install a similar kind of system. Today, as we speak, you see U.S. imperialism involved in a 16-17 year war in Afghanistan that is called the Forever War. You see that in the last decade or so, the United States invaded Iraq, toppled Saddam Hussein, and then presided over his execution. You see that in the last decade or so, the United States went into Libya after Libya had relinquished its so-called weapons of mass destruction, that is to say nuclear weaponry, and presided over the ousting of Colonel Gaddafi, the leader, and then stood by idly as he was murdered. And now we see the United States issuing threats, very dangerous threats against the regime in North Korea. So yes, the United States remains the major purveyor of violence in the world today, as it was 50 years or so ago when Dr. King made those prophetic words.
Now, after Dr. King had his successes with civil rights, why did he shift to the war?
Well, I think he realized what many of us realize today, that it was fatuous to talk about solving problems of education and health care when a disproportionate share of our tax dollars are going to the Pentagon to fight wars. Right. Wars in Indochina when he was alive, and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and increasingly, I'm afraid, North Korea in 2018.
Now, one thing that struck me about that speech is the connection he makes between the poverty and war. In other words, that the Vietnam War diverted momentum and resources from the civil rights movement. Can you talk about this dynamic in light of our current militarism? Did he believe, in a sense, war was a pretext for ignoring poverty?
Well, certainly. I don't think that you could take seriously the ideas of President Lyndon Baines Johnson in the so-called Great Society and the so-called war on poverty, because he was at the same time fighting this war in Vietnam and indeed in all of Indochina. Likewise, during that particular period, you may recall that the United States was one of the major supporters of apartheid South Africa. Right. How could you credibly talk about fighting a war on poverty when you're basically perpetuating poverty in Southern Africa? It was a contradiction very difficult for Dr. King to swallow.
Well, referring back to the drum major speech, Dr. King seems to work from the perspective of humility and sort of being cognizant of our impulse for attention. Is there any lesson in that for today's activists? What do you think Dr. King would think about Twitter and some of the grandstanding that accompanies activism?
Well, I mean, certainly this country could take and accept very easily a dose of humility. But with respect, I think that that humility should begin at the top. It should begin with those who are wielding the power against the rest of us. Although certainly your point is well taken with regard to activists and some of the needless Twitter storms and Twitter wars that erupt almost effortlessly, I think that our movement would benefit with less of that.
We already talked about his views on poverty. How did he view the intersection of race and poverty? For example, in Baltimore, much of the worst concentrations of poverty are in African-American neighborhoods. What did he think about the reality of how racially oriented poverty is in this country?
Well, I think that it was an inevitable result, he would say, of the fact that the population of African descent was mostly enslaved. And then after the abolition of slavery, circa 1865, there were not concerted programs to help to uplift this population from the ravages of slavery. Instead, you had the rise of the Ku Klux Klan and terrorist organizations that successfully deprived this black population of the right to vote. You had the cascading of racism, which hampered the ability of black Americans to get work or to live in certain neighborhoods or even earn a decent living. And what you see in Baltimore today is the inevitable result of what I've just described. That is to say that even today, there has not been and there is not a concerted effort to address the ravages of slavery and of Jim Crow, not to mention contemporary racism.
As we're thinking about his assassination, what lesson from Dr. King would be most relevant in the Trump era? What would he say about President Trump? And more important, how would he counsel us to deal with a country that seems to be veering towards intolerance and division under Trump's leadership?
Well, I think that one of the reasons why Dr. King was killed was because he sought to internationalize the struggle against domestic racism. Mm-hmm. I think that's the clear implication of his coming out four square against the war in Indochina. It's very dangerous for organizations and leaders to seek assistance abroad against antagonists and enemies at home. And certainly, I think that that's one of the lessons that we have to ingest and imbibe today in 2018. That is to say that we're facing a formidable foe in the 63 million strong voting bloc that propelled Donald J. Trump into the White House. Right. Historically, we have been able to overcome slavery, then Jim Crow, precisely because we internationalized that struggle. Unless and until we do the same today, I'm afraid to say that we will be continuing to face a formidable antagonist in the White House and one Donald J. Trump.
There's one question I'd like to ask about some of the current events regarding the controversy over the FBI surveillance of Trump. Now, of course, the present conflict is over foreign surveillance, but as we all know, the FBI surveilled Dr. King extensively. Have Republicans ever criticized this lawless misuse of surveillance?
Well, I think your question answers itself. I mean, obviously, this is the height of hypocrisy. That the Republicans are raising these searching questions about the FBI today in 2018 when they did not have a mumbling word to say about the surveillance of Dr. King. Or alternatively, you could say they were cheerleading and giving high fives to the FBI when the FBI was putting bugs in Dr. King's hotel rooms and tapping his telephones and harassing him. I think that there are still questions to be answered indeed about the tragic murder of Dr. King on April 4th, 1968. That is to say that the late leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, Congressman Lewis Stokes of Cleveland, did an investigation while he was in Congress that suggested that there was a high-level conspiracy to kill Dr. King. This was the conclusion of a body of Congress, not of a novelist, not of a screenplay writer. And indeed, I think that the Stokes report needs to be reexamined as we approach the anniversary of Dr. King's murder.
Is there anything that racial justice activists today should take from Dr. King's legacy moving forward?
Well, there are a number of things. One, I would say the attempt to internationalize the struggle. The Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black Lives have made steps in that direction by hosting investigators from the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations in terms of their inspection of poverty and deprivation of basic rights in the United States of America, but more needs to be done. I think that there needs to be closer coordination with progressive trade unions. I think, for example, the Hospital Workers Union, which is headquartered in New York City, which Dr. King considered to be his favorite union, which he worked with hand in glove. I think that those are the two basic lessons that Dr. King's life imparts to today's activists.
I would like to thank my guest, Professor Horn, for this important conversation about Dr. King's legacy, and my producer, Stephen Janis, for his research. And I would like to thank you for joining me at The Real News.
I know that you've heard all kinds of stories about me. That I am a racist. That I am a supporter of the KKK. That I am against civil rights. All because I oppose the Martin Luther King holiday. But I am opposed to the holiday. And I will stay opposed to it as long as I am in office. And as long as there are city officials that agree with me, there will be no holiday in this state.
This is Mr. Soldier. Public Enemy, Security of the First World, and all aligned forces are traveling west to head off a white supremacist team to destroy the national celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. Public Enemy believes that the powers that be in the states of New Hampshire and Arizona have found psychological discomfort in paying tribute to a black man who tried to teach white people the meaning of civilization. Good luck, brothers. Show them what you got.
Jackets on the elephant, 20,000 Nikki puppets in the corner of the cell block, but they cover California. Population is none in a desert is sun, with a gun cracker running things under his thumb, staring hard at the postcard. Isn't it odd and unique seeing people smile while in a heat 120 degree? Cause I wanna be free. What's a smiling face when the whole state's racist? Why I wanna hound they damn it? Cause I wanna. So if I celebrate it, standing on a corner, I ain't drinking no 40, drinking time with a 9. Till we get some land, call me the trigger man. Looking for the governor, huh? He ain't loving you hot, but hear the trouble, yeah, he's rubbing you wrong. Get the point and come along, he can get to the joint. I urinated on the state while I was kicking this song. Yeah, you better be fair, the sucker over there. You try to keep it yesteryear, the good old days, the same old ways that kept us dying. Hey, yes, you, me, myself, and I, indeed. What he need is a nosebleed, be between the lines. And then you see the lie, politically planned. And understand that's all she wrote. When we see the real side to hide behind a vote. And they can't understand why he the man. I'm singing by the king. They don't like it when I decide to make it. Wait, I'm waiting for the day for the man who demands respect. Cause he was great. Come on, I'm on a one mission. To get a politician to honor, or he's a donor by the time I get to Arizona. Well, I got 25 days to do it. If a war in the way, just watch me go through it. Cause I gotta do what I gotta do. PE number one gets the job done when it's done and over. Well, it's because I drove her through all the static. I stick for automatic. That's the way it is. She got to get his talking MLK. Gonna find a way. Make this stay. Hey, I'm looking for the day. Hard as it seems, this ain't no damn dream. Gotta know what I mean. This team against team, catch the light beam. So I pray every day I do every shot I make. Looking for culture I got, but not here for Jamaica. Pushing and shaking the structure, bringing down the Babylon. Here in the circle to make it hard for the brown. The hard boulevard, I need it now, more than ever now. Who's sitting on my freedom oppressor? People beater, a piece of the pick. We picked a piece of the land we're serving now. Reparation, a piece of the nation, damn, we got the nerve. Another nigga they say and classify, we want too much. My people plus the nine is mine, don't think I even double dust. Here's a brother, my attitude is here to hang up high. I'm blowing up the 90s, started ticking in 86. When the prime get a mind, better start fearing while we singing now. There will be the day we know who's down and who will go, 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 go. By the time I get to Arizona, by the time I get to Arizona,
listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that of course was Public Enemy with By the Time I Get to Arizona. Now, of course, we also listened to Gerald Horn in his talk about the incredibly offensive use of Martin Luther King by the Ford Motor Company, effectively to sell Dodge Ram trucks at the Super Bowl ads. And of course, it's not the first time that Martin Luther King has been used in this kind of way and sanitized and whitewashed. And effectively, in this case, used to sell products. You know, this is an incredibly, offensive, disgusting thing. And Gerald Horn briefly mentioned the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and expressed his doubts as the official narrative about his killing, something which many others have had over the years. And I want to focus on that right now here in the last part of the show, because, as you'll see, there is considerable documentary evidence that the United States government did in fact conspire to murder King, because they indeed viewed him as a threat for his anti-war stance on Vietnam, to his, for his anti-war stance on Vietnam, for his growing criticism of the capitalist system in America, for his mobilization of working class people and his plans on initiating a tent city Occupy style protest in Washington, D.C. around the issue of poverty. And, you know, an increasingly radical message he was delivering to oppressed African Americans. The next clip is of Barry Zwicker discussing the details of Martin Luther King's assassination in light of evidence available now. And after that, I'm going to play a piece by William Pepper, who, in fact, wrote a book called An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, back in 2008. And it's really one of the best books currently available on the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And so that's what I'm going to close the show out with. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Most everyone knows that Dr. King was a courageous Christian minister committed to the nonviolent pursuit of freedom for all people. In this pursuit, he went to jail 29 times. Nothing new so far, but prepare yourself for some stunning surprises. James Earl Ray, a petty criminal who died in 1998 and who, according to the official story, shot Dr. King, in fact, did not shoot Dr. King, even though he pleaded guilty in 1969. That's right, James Earl Ray was not, absolutely without any question, not the killer. This footage of Dexter King shaking hands with James Earl Ray speaks volumes. Dexter and the other members of the King family have persevered ever since Dr. King's death to learn the truth about what happened and to make that truth known. They are convinced Ray was not the shooter. Ray's guilty plea comes about on the advice of a lawyer who approaches Ray and offers to represent him. It turns out this lawyer has connections with the true killers. The lawyer tells Ray that a guilty plea will make Ray famous and help him get off with a light sentence. Always easily led, Ray writes out what he's told to. And by the way, it's a guilty plea, not a confession. These facts are found in a book just out. The best single book on the assassination, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. On the basis of the guilty plea, Ray is sentenced to 99 years in prison. Ray realizes he's been duped. 3 days after arriving in the penitentiary, he moves for his guilty plea to be set aside and that he be given a trial. But stalling by government officials denies him that for the rest of his life. To his dying day, he insists he did not kill Dr. King. Pepper's book includes a full account of the extensive civil trial into Dr. King's death, held in Memphis, Tennessee in 1999. That there was such a trial may be a surprise to you also. The family's suit names as defendants co-conspirators, both named and unknown. The trial is not about money. The family seeks $100 damages. The trial is about the truth. The trial lasts almost a month. 70 witnesses are heard. A jury of 6 black and 6 white persons takes just 1 hour to arrive at a guilty verdict against, quote, the co-conspirators, consisting of the named defendant, Lloyd Jowers, and those that the defendant named in his response, namely, the United States government, the state of Tennessee, the city of Memphis, and Memphis Police Department, James Earl Ray, Earl Clark, and Frank Liberto, unquote. Earl Clark, now deceased, was the top marksman in the Memphis Police Department. Frank Liberto was a mafia kingpin. Conspirators within the U.S. government, according to the trial and the book, include, quote, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, and the military, unquote. The reason all this information probably surprises you is that the mainstream media effectively boycotted the trial. As Pepper writes, the silence following these shocking revelations was deafening. Like the pattern during all the investigations of the assassination throughout the years, no major media outlet would cover the story. It was effectively buried. Just 6 of the many facts that come out at the trial. First, when King arrives in Memphis, he's taken not to his usual hotel, which is safe for him, but rather to another, and given a room he must reach by an exposed balcony readily visible from dense bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill across the street, and from various high vantage points. Second fact, a special security unit of black officers assigned to King on all his previous visits to Memphis is told it's not required this time. Third fact, defendant Jowers, former owner of Jim's Bar and Grill, admits to receiving and storing a gun the day before the killing, being handed a still-smoking gun the day of, and disposing of that gun. Fourth, U.S. Army snipers are positioned on two nearby rooftops and a water tower, not, as you'd expect, to protect King, but to back up the assassin in case he misses. He does not. Fifth fact, New York Times reporter Earl Caldwell is in a room close to King's. He comes out when he hears the shot. He and others testify for the trial that they saw a man crouching in the bushes behind Jim's Bar and Grill. This man cannot be James Earl Ray. Reliable witnesses see Ray leave the area before the shot is fired. Fact 6. The day after the killing, early in the morning, a City Works crew is sent to cut down and methodically remove the bushes and all debris from behind Jim's Bar and Grill. The order comes from the Memphis Police Department. Whoever killed King, it was not James Earl Ray. He could never have coordinated such a plan or assembled such a task force, and he wasn't at the scene. He is the fall guy. But the trial, in effect, is boycotted by the media. That's why you don't know about it. That's why I didn't know about it until 3 months ago, through James Douglas. King recognized that powerful economic forces stunt history and kill hope. It's important to understand that these powerful forces now include the mainstream media. To study Dr. Martin Luther King's nonviolent quest for social and economic justice as the surest foundation for peace is to recognize him not only as a civil rights leader, but as a man of the hour, even in these troubling days. King's life and death remain important news.
This work, Act of State, will, like Orders to Kill, will not be reviewed in the United States and any of the mainstream media. So it's nice to be in a place where there are friends present and there is some receptivity to the story, which, however sad it is and however indicative it is of the pervasive sickness of this, our native land. In a very real sense, this saga begins in Vietnam. I was a journalist there in 1966, and I traveled throughout the country until my presence became a bit intolerable. And I came back to the United States and then published. And Martin King read one of the articles that was written in a magazine called Ramparts. It's January 1967 issue of Ramparts called The Children of Vietnam. Some of you may remember it. It's an old San Francisco-based muckraking magazine. To understand the horror of Vietnam, the passion that one had to feel for that ancient land and those magnificent people, one has to resort to photographs to show what happened, and poetry, because prose is never sufficient. And Martin was moved by the photographs in that piece, and eventually by the poetry that he had me recite to his congregation. And that poem was one that some of you may or may not have heard. It's, I come and stand at every door, but no one hears my silent plea. I stand and yet remain unseen, for I am dead, for I am dead. I am only seven, though I died in My Lai. Long ago, I'm seven now as I was then. When children die, they do not grow. My hair was scorched by swirling flame. My eyes grew dim, my eyes grew blind. Death came and turned my bones to dust. And that was scattered by the wind. All that I ask is but for peace. You fight today, so that the children of this world may live and grow and laugh and play. Now the children of My Lai and their mothers and their grandparents were of course slaughtered one day in the middle of March, about the time that Bobby Kennedy decided he would declare for the presidency. On almost the very day he made his declaration, in March 1968, My Lai went on, only to be discovered by the Western world almost a year later. But My Lai was one village of hundreds. And when Martin King stumbled upon his January subscription to Ramparts at the Atlanta airport, as he was heading off to the West Indies, going through his post, and he came on these photographs, he pushed it away. Pushed away the food that was in front of him and the post that was in front of him and the magazine that was in front of him. And he froze. And Bernard Lee, his bodyguard, said, "What, Martin, what's wrong? What's something wrong with your food?" And he said, "No, there's nothing wrong with my food, Bernard. I haven't tasted it, but I'll never enjoy food so long as this war continues." Now, he'd had the seeds growing within him for a number of years about this war in Vietnam. And he'd had the compassion growing within him for a number of years about the wretched of the earth and their plight when he was in India and he saw poverty that he had never seen before. And he was inclined to oppose this war, but then all of a sudden it came together at the Atlanta airport. And he said he would have to do this. So he asked then to meet with me. And I opened the files to him on a first time on a car trip from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we were to preside over the opening of a Vietnam summer group. And as he went through the residue of materials, he couldn't contain himself and he started to weep. Now, remember that. So deeply was he touched by what we were doing to those people. And everything I'm telling you tonight about that experience all those years ago, remember, 36 years ago, I want you to think about today and what we were about to do once again. Because it doesn't seem as though the world has changed very much, at least not in these national boundaries. So he said then, right, I've got to now take this position and I've got to formalize it. And that was, of course, to be done on April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed. But he said, "I'm going to lose all of the support I've had in the civil rights movement. All the leaders will walk away from me. And all of the media will start to condemn me. I will be called a traitor, and I will have no one to whom I can turn, except perhaps my congregation and my brothers and sisters in SCLC. He said, "But you know, Bill, I'm a little worried about my congregation, because they know me as a pastor and as a civil rights leader. And now I'm coming into a realm of activity which is taking on the government of the United States that has done the most for civil rights in terms of legislation of any government in the history of this country. I'm having to take on the Johnson administration and opposing that war. And that's, my people are going to have a concern about that. So I want you to come down to Ebenezer Baptist Church and I want you to take the pulpit and I want you to speak to my people. And I want you to tell them why I have to oppose this war." And I thought he went around the bend. I said, "You want this white kid from the north, I was just a little more than a kid, to come down and talk to your people. Your people. Tell them why you have to oppose this war. Martin, these are your people." Yeah. They might not even understand how I pronounce words. And he waved his finger in front of my face. I always remember this. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, you've been there. You've seen it. You come and you tell them why their pastor has a moral obligation to oppose the actions of this government against this people. And I couldn't say very much for that. I went down and I did speak that Sunday. Bishop Pike had been the guest preacher the week before, Bishop of California, and I don't know if I did any good, but at least I did what he asked me to do, as I usually did during the course of that last year, and that was the only year that I knew him, was that last year. Then, on April 15th, 1967, he spoke at the United Nations, in front of the United Nations at the plaza, and came out forcefully against the war. Following this magnificent speech on April 4th, he spoke on April 15th. I introduced him that day. As agreed, I threw out for the first time the possibility that he should be pressed to run for the presidency of the United States with Benjamin Spock as his running mate, Dr. Benjamin Spock as his running mate, as an alternative to the Johnson war machine and the continuation of the administration. There was an overwhelming reaction, positive support to that suggestion, and Martin spoke to that assembled throng. Then we began to put together the National Conference for New Politics, and I agreed to run that that last year, and that organization was the umbrella organization designed to make it all happen. It had a national convention in Chicago on Labor Day weekend, 1967. It was attended by 5,000 delegates from all over the United States. Every socioeconomic group was there. Every ethnic group in this country was represented. Every geographical area. It was the largest convention of people ever assembled in the history of this republic. And we were on the road, so we thought, to the nomination of that endorsement of that third party. So I introduced him as the keynote speaker and sat down, and as he was delivering the keynote address at the Palmer House in Chicago, I was passed a note. A note came over my shoulder, and I looked at it and I read it, and it said, "Get him out of here after he finishes his speech, or we will take him hostage and humiliate him before the world." Now, who are the we? The we were a black caucus that had been formed prior to the convention, but were in the assembly, and as every black delegate came in, they were pulled into the black caucus room and made members of the Black Caucus, pressed effectively into service. And we thought this was a very good thing, because we thought that the blacks in America should have unified policy and concerted effort and attention being given to the problems both rural and urban blacks faced in America, and that this was healthy, and that the rest of the contingents who were there should look at the issues that were being raised. How naive we were, because we didn't know at the time that that group had been formed and led by agents provocateurs, which had been organized by the government of the United States, Department of Labor, Mayor Richard Daley's poverty program, and were led by the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago gang. So their whole purpose then was to disrupt the convention, make sure that it was not successful. And we didn't have a clue how naive we were. And they did that, and they were successful. They pushed through resolutions that alienated one group from another, drove money away from the movement, and ensured the fact that we were starting from a very difficult point of view. So that was a sad lesson to learn, but we believed a lot of it at the time was unfortunate, but not malicious. And it was only years later that we would learn of the government involvement through Freedom of Information Act applications. Throughout that last year of his life, however, Martin King continued to campaign against the war and to try to relate to the problems of poor people. He was killed for two reasons. One was the opposition to the war, which was powerful and growing, and going to the bottom lines of major transnational corporations who were profiting from the war, both construction companies, oil and gas companies, as well as the armaments industries. They were the ones that were going to suffer from any kind of early end to this Vietnam adventure. And Martin King was developing a support throughout the country, particularly amongst a white middle class, northern liberal, Midwestern liberal folks who were tiring of this adventure. We brought 100 Vietnamese war-injured children to the United States in the course of that year, and they were placed in hospitals all over America for the purpose of getting restorative surgery from the various bombing effects and disfigurements and shrapnel wounds and things of that sort. Some of you who are old enough may remember photographs on posters and placards of children whose features were horribly disfigured because of the effects of the napalm in particular. Some of those photographs are mine, and some of those photographs are the reason that Martin King was moved in the first instance. So the war was a major issue, but the primary issue, I've concluded over the years, that he was taken out had to do with a whole other set of values and a whole other orientation. It had to do with his commitment to the poor people of this republic. He had to commit himself to the redistribution of wealth, the reallocation of resources, so that the wretched of America would have a chance to live. Black, white, Indian, whatever ethnic background, whatever racial background, whatever geographical area, he was trying to forge that alliance. And that was what was critical. He was getting involved now in human rights issues that spanned the entire globe. He was no longer a civil rights leader. He was now a human rights advocate and a prophet. He had been moved by the wretched situation of the poor in India in the 1960. He carried that with him, and now he was determined to do something about that in his native land. That was the ultimate goal. It was no good to have all these civil rights, you know? You could go to any restaurant you wanted to and eat in any restaurant you wanted to, and go to any hotel you wanted to. What good was that kind of right if you couldn't afford it? That was the point. So you had to enable people to enable themselves to be able to afford it. And that required assistance from government. That required the restoration of programs that had been taken away and denied because of the war. So there was the grand project. He was going to bring masses of people to the nation's capital, and they were going to camp there. Not march, camp. They were going to live in a tent city in the shadow of the Washington Memorial. For as long as it took, they were going to go up the hill, visit their congressmen, their senators, and try to get these programs restored, and try to get these funds placed back into the use of the people. That was the plan. That was the second reason why he was killed, because the army believed he would not be successful. They believed that the angry mob of wretchedly poor people would get angrier, and they would get it beyond the control of this nonviolent, peaceful leader, and they would be taken over by militants who would lead a revolutionary force on the streets of the Capitol, the likes of which America had never seen, and America would have then its second revolution, a social revolution, for which it had been waiting for so long, for which Mr. Roosevelt had frustrated in the 30s with the New Deal programs. So they feared this would happen. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more troops in Vietnam. They didn't have the troops for him. They didn't have the troops to put down that revolution. And because of that, Martin King was not going to be allowed to bring that mob to Washington. So those were the two reasons why he was killed. Now, he was assassinated on the 4th of April, 1968. As he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel at 6:01 p.m., a shot came from across the other side of Mulberry Street from an elevated position, struck him on a downward path here, exited here, came back in here, went down and lodged just below his shoulder blade, clipping his spine along the way. He fell, and he was eventually taken away to a hospital, St. Joseph's Hospital, where he died at about 7 p.m. The state moved very quickly to conduct an investigation, and they ultimately identified the assassin as one James Earl Ray. Said that he was a lone assassin. I'm not quite sure why he did it. Probably because he was a racist, or he was looking for money. And he was eventually arrested at Heathrow Airport and extradited to the United States. Now, the state's position from the beginning, 1968, right to the present time, would you believe, to the present time, is that James Earl Ray acted alone for whatever his motives were. He bought a rifle in Birmingham, Alabama, carried it to Memphis, Tennessee, rented a room in this rooming house, which was just opposite the Lorraine Motel, knew King was going to be there, went into the bathroom, waited until he showed up on the balcony, shot him, ran back to the room he rented, took all his belongings in a bag, put the rifle in it, ran down the stairs, out into Main Street, the main street of the city, turned left, started to run toward his car, saw a police car parked this way, drawn up to the sidewalk by the fire station, dropped the bundle in panic in a door, got into his Mustang, drove away, eventually went to Atlanta, parked the car in a housing development parking lot, and then made his way to Canada, and eventually made his way to the United Kingdom, and where after one trip to Portugal, he was trying to get to Africa. He was picked up and brought back to the United States. So James Earl Ray was the accused assassin. He was brought back, and he was imprisoned. He was held in Shelby County Jail, lights on for 24 hours, cameras on for 24 hours, under full surveillance. His lawyer was a man called Arthur Haynes. The Haynes father and son team defended him. Art Haynes was paid for his defense by making an alliance with a writer called William Bradford Huey. Huey had a contract with Look magazine, so Huey paid Haynes for giving him inside stories on the case. When James Earl Ray found out that information he was giving to Haynes, that Haynes was giving to Huey, was going to the FBI, who were visiting people whose names he was revealing, James got very uncomfortable with this whole arrangement, and he fired Art Haynes. And he brought on the Texas Tiger, Percy Forman. And Percy Forman began to represent James, and he was determined there was going to be a trial, and that's why he came on. And then lo and behold, at the last minute, virtually at the midnight hour, Percy said, James, you got to plead guilty. And you got to plead guilty because they got you convicted, media's convicted you, they're going to fry your ass, she said. They're going to send your father back to Idaho. He violated parole there 50 years ago. They're going to send him back to jail. They're going to harass your family. And James, my health is not very good, and I can't give you your best defense. So I think it's better for you to plead guilty. James said that was the last, that last reason was the one that made, really made him decide to plead. And Percy said, when you plead, that's all right. You hire another lawyer and you can overturn this guilty plea and you get yourself a trial and you'll get a lawyer who's healthy and fit can represent you. James said, I haven't got any money to hire a lawyer, Percy. He said, that's all right. Don't worry about that. I'll give you the money. I'll pay Jerry, your brother, $500. He can go hire a lawyer. Now, Percy not only told him this, he put it in writing. He put this in an actual letter. Dear James, I'm advancing you this money, $500, on the condition that you will cause no problems at the guilty plea hearing. So here's the lawyer, the man, talking him into pleading guilty and paying for him to hire a new lawyer. So James pled on March 10th, 1969. And on March 13th, 1969, he filed his motion papers for a new trial. And from March 13th, 1969, till the day he died in 1998, April 1998, he tried to get this trial that he never had. So, Judge Preston Battle was reviewing those papers on March 31st, 1969. Judge Battle was the judge of the case. Who had sentenced him to 99 years, accepted the plea, but he'd become a little concerned about some aspects of the evidence and some things that he hadn't been told. So he was taking his time in ruling on this motion. But on March 31st, 1969, his time was up because he died of a heart attack. He was found at his desk in his chambers with his head on James Ilray's motion paper. Now, under Tennessee law, when you die of a heart attack or any other kind of cause of death, and a motion is pending before you as a judge, the motion is automatically granted. There were two motions for a new trial pending for Judge Preston Battle when he died. And guess who did not get the trial? And guess who did get it? Well, James did not get it. And so he started his own pro se motions, and he had a variety of lawyers to try to help him get a trial over the years before I met him. When Martin was killed, I went to the memorial service in Memphis and the funeral in Atlanta with Ben Spock, and Bob Kennedy invited us to go up and have a word in his suite in Atlanta, and I think a number of my friends did go. And Benjamin went, and Julian Bond, and some others. I just decided I'd had it, so I didn't go. I'd known Bob Kennedy when I was a much even younger person, 64, when I handled his campaign, Westchester County. I was a citizens chairman. I didn't like him then. I didn't like his brother-in-law, Steve Smith. I didn't like any of the family. I thought he was opportunistic, arrogant, and didn't understand how the real world functioned, real people had to live. And that was my assessment of Bob Kennedy in 64 after working with him. But now I regret I didn't go see him in 68 because I think he was quite a different person. I think he had gotten out. I think he'd been to Mississippi. I think he'd seen people living under floors. And I think Bob Kennedy, who was assassinated, was really quite a different person. And so I have that regret. But in any event, I was finished with politics, and so I walked away. 9 years later, Ralph Abernathy called and he said, I'd like to go up and have you interrogate James Earl Ray in front of me so I can hear what he has to say. I said, what do you mean? You want to hear what he has to say? I thought he'd gone around the bend. I said, isn't he guilty, Ralph? I never gave it a second thought. I thought they had the right guy. He pled, didn't he? I didn't know any of the story of the way he pled. And I said, well, I think I'd like to do this. Will you do it? So I don't know anything about the case. It took me several months. It's like it's fine the time. I got did research. Then we went to see James Earl Ray in August 1978. And I believed I was going to see very aggressive, angry, racist guy who was very knowledgeable about weapons and who was probably very astute at being a con man. And so I was prepared for all of that. And brought a psychiatrist from Harvard who was a friend of mine, Howie Behrens. He was a body language specialist. He would sit in the corner, and as I batted away at Ray, he was supposed to watch him and see how he flinched, what movements he made, and give me some indication of anxiety reactions, things of that sort. We did this for 5 hours, and I hit him very hard. And Ralph said this long prayer at the beginning, set the tone. Then fell asleep occasionally throughout the 5 hours, as Ralph always did. Well, I was on platforms with Ralph, and Martin was speaking, and Ralph would start to snore. And I'd end up hitting him in the ribs, and I'd wake him up. You know, he just had this sleepy temperament, I guess you might say. So anyway, we came away from that interview, and James had answered questions as directly as he could, with a totally different view of this person. First of all, this was a guy who was painfully shy. He was quiet-spoken. If anything, he was docile. He wasn't aggressive. It emerged he wasn't a racist at all. When he worked in a shoe factory, he would shoot craps with the black workers after. He'd go to a bar with them. He hung out with black workers who were colleagues of his. He had nothing against black people. He knew very little about guns, and he was a very poor shot. His army records were abysmal in terms of his ability with a rifle. And he was a petty stick-up guy who, when he was out of work, used to hang out in a bar, and somebody would come up with a good idea, and he'd fall in line with it, and he got in so much trouble by hanging out in bars and hearing these good ideas that he ended up spending a lot of time in jail. You know, so, he was incompetent. Even as a stick-up man, he was incompetent. He couldn't sometimes get to a supermarket on time to hold it up. By that, I mean, not that it would be closed, but that the time lock would have been set on the safe. And he would come in after the time lock had already been set on the safe. And he'd go to the guy at the cashier and say, "Well, now, why don't you get me that money from the saving?" I'd say, "Mister, the lock is set. There's nothing we can do about it. I mean, we'll give you our money, but there's nothing we can do about that time lock." And he would, "I don't want your money. I want the money in there." So he was incompetent. He used to carry five bullets in a six-bullet cylinder. And it took me years to get him to admit why he only had five rather than six bullets. When he was captured at Heathrow Airport, he had a gun and he had five bullets. And he said, finally he admitted to me one time, he said, "Well, I used to always keep the firing pin cylinder empty." He said, "Because once I shot myself in the foot. That's embarrassing." So this is the nature of this guy. Who was an escaped convict and on the run, and who once, when he escaped from prison, he was aided by the falling asleep of a guard. And when there was an internal investigation, when they caught him, they brought him back and they put him up to try to find out how he escaped and how he managed to get out. He refused to testify against the guard, refused to tell on the guard. And I said, "Why'd you do that?" I said, "Well, you know." The reason he gave was, "Well, I might need him again someday," or something like, something like that. But he had this con mentality that he would not ever tell on anybody who he thought was legitimately trying to help him. And I think he was fooled very often in terms of who was trying to help him and who wasn't. So, but I could never quite bridge that. Anyway. We came away from that meeting with this man with a very different view. We came away with the opinion that he did not shoot Martin Luther King. We didn't know what other role he might have played, but we believed he didn't shoot Dr. King. But he raised enough questions in my own mind to let me be worried about what the truth really was, and be concerned about whether or not, in fact, we knew what happened to Martin King. And I thought it was important enough that this enormous figure was taken from us.